whoa, yeah, we are in the place to be. Hi and welcome to What's Next. I'm Therese, your host, and in this week's episode we have amazing guests on the show. So let's get started right away. Have fun listening. Good morning. How are you?
Hey. Really good. Thank you.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm really good as well. I'm really happy that you said yes to the interview.
You're welcome. We're very excited to be able to do this.
Then we start with the first question. Who are you? Please introduce your office.
Well, for the listeners, for you, you can see we're Bram and Hans.
Yes.
I'm Bram.
I'm Hans.
And we're Studio Okami Architects. And we're recording this from our office in Antwerp. In the Riverside Tower, 10th floor, with the views over the city of Antwerp. But of course, you can't see that. We could be anywhere. We could be lying. Yeah.
You're in some basement, and you put a picture, and then a picture of
you can see. Tell them.
Riverside Tower sounds really nice.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is. It's a brutalist tower designed by Leon Stannen and Paul Lemaire, two quite famous Belgian architects in the 70s.
Brutalist style, yeah, all concrete.
All concrete, just the way we love it.
Am I wrong, or do you have your apartment that I saw in different magazines online in the same building?
Yeah, it's correct. Place, yes. Yeah. It's my private apartment. So it's on the 13th and 14th floor. It's a duplex. And I take the elevator down to the 10th floor, where is the office. So, yeah, no morning queues or traffic jams. Unless everybody wants to get out of the building,
yeah,
I have to wait for the elevator.
Sometimes it's busy at the elevator. Yeah.
But your apartment looks really beautiful.
Thank you.
Really beautiful. But before we start with this, I have some warm-up questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favorite drink? Alcoholic, non-alcoholic?
Yeah, we tried them last night again to figure out which one would be our favorite.
But I really like water, though.
Yeah, some nice sparkling water.
Yeah, no, well, still and sparkling, but water is always nice. Not the answer you may have hoped.
No, for it really depends on the occasion. For me, it's like, of course, a nice beer with friends on a terrace or when you're partying. It's for sure a classic.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like a wind down drink when I come from work at home, it would be like a white Russian. That's my favorite, I think, for the moment.
For me, anything not too licorice, not like pastis or so. All the rest is fine.
I started drinking White Russian after the movie Big Lebowski.
But it's actually a Belgian invention, eh? The White Russian cocktail. Yeah, it's from 1940s. In a bar in Brussels, it was made for like the ambassador from the US for Luxembourg or something. And he said to the bartender, make me something special. And the guy mixed up the first White Russian. So it's actually Belgian invention. But that's not the reason why I like it.
If you could develop a skill overnight, what would you wish for? It can be anything.
It's super difficult because at first you think about all these superman, superhuman like skills. But for me, it would be, I think, time traveling, but like without being able to disturb the timelines and those kind of things. But like if I would be able to time travel and then choose to be visible or non-visible in the situation, that I think would be amazing.
Yeah. All the unlimited superpowers are nice too, of course, you know, like you, that yeah. you can...
But with great powers yeah. come great responsibilities.
That's true, that's true. Or be able to sing really nicely.
Oh, yeah, possibly. Yeah.
At least that they recognize the song when you sing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is what you wish for, to sing nice.
It's our superpowers or to be able to sing really nice.
And yeah, then maybe we wouldn't be architects, but mm-hmm. just a band. Right,
that's something. The reason why.
What's your favorite hobby besides architecture?
It's very, yeah. These warm-up questions are actually more difficult than the real questions, I think. No, but...
Life in general, sports, yeah. Traveling, music, all the like going out with
we're very firm believers that as an architect you should really live and be out there and explore a lot of things, from countries to food to all different kind of experiences, because in a sense what you do when you design is you bring out all these experience into your concepts and your designs, and you need to be able to also visualize yourself in the life of your clients, for instance. Mm-hmm. And by living life to the fullest, you actually gain a lot of luggage that you can use in those kind of design processes. Mm-hmm. And that's also why in the office we have very strict business hours. We start at 9 o'clock and we finish at 5 and we have an hour break just to make sure that after work you still have enough things that you can do to experience. Mm-hmm. And at first it's weird, but actually it works to really limit the time you spend in the office. That doesn't mean that you're not working in your head and you're not processing.
True. That's true.
But
especially for design and stuff, you can reflect at other time, other moments, other time frames, and for design that's true. But it's interesting to leave everything at 5 and just do something else completely different.
Yeah, and it also makes everything more efficient, in a sense that if you really want to leave the office at 5, you should also work accordingly. You should be able to, like, some days we're like working non-stop, but it's between 9 and 5 we forget to eat almost, like you're busy, and then at 5 it's like, okay, this is it for today, and we make like a list of the stuff that we want to complete, and then we crank it out, so to speak.
So living life to the fullest. And on the other side, this 9-to-5 job, does this match?
Yeah,
that's the perfect combination.
Really? Because I hear so many people always complaining about this 9-to-5 every day.
Yeah, but that's because what they do between 9 and 5 is not as interesting as being in an architecture office, I guess. You should make sure that the work you do between 9 and 5 is so interesting that it doesn't bore you out.
And I think the alternative was working longer than 5.
Yeah, so. The alternative would be from 9 to 9 or something. Yeah. So that's even worse.
So, indeed.
So I have the feeling we start this podcast a little different. The next question would be, how do you start your design process? But since we are in this living life to the fullest and from 9 to 5 schedule, I would like to stay there a little bit more.
But it's funny because a lot of friends and other architects that we know, there's this idea among architects that you need to work long hours, work through nights to get the best design to because otherwise you didn't do your job. And I think it's different. You can easily manage to do all these designs between 9 and 5 if you stick to it. And the clients know it. They don't call us after 5. They know, like, that's the case, that's the way we work, and
Yeah.
And for example, I'm your employee. Do I have to come to the office or can I work from wherever I want?
No, you have to come.
You have to come to the office.
I have to come.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's we in the office, and that's also part of the design process, ideas bounce around. We have several projects in different stages that are always continuing, and you handle a certain part of a certain project, and then 50 minutes later, you're busy with another thing, and the ideas bounce around. You need to be able to see each other, to walk past somebody who's working on the computer, and then to interact and say, like, ah, what did I see? And sometimes you misinterpret what you see on the screen, but it kind of all adds up to...
Also, because everyone is involved in every phase of the process. Mm-hmm. If it would be only execution, or if you would only do a small part, something that you can separate from the rest of the process, then it would supposedly be fine to work from at home or whatever. But it's never the case.
It's
never the case.
No, we tried it during the pandemic between Hans and me to work at home, but we you miss so many little interactions, you miss so many little details that when you're together in one space, it's totally different.
This is for us, of course.
Yeah, that's the way we work.
The way we work, we give instant feedback on small things, like yes or no. And you can even tell it when you see the expression, or you feel which direction you go. And
it's really part of the design process. Like when a client comes to us, and we never make a contract for a full project. We always say, like, okay, we do the sketch design, and if you like the sketch design, we're willing to make a contract. Mm-hmm. And the reason we do that is we don't want to commit the client to us, and we want to find the perfect client for the project.
Match, yeah.
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 Because we believe that it's easy to make good architecture, to make a good design. That's easy because you're skilled as an architect to do so.
Mm.
But what is difficult is to get it built. And to get it built, you need the right client, the person that trusts you with your design. So in our process, when the brief comes in or we sat down with the client, we just start in the office designing, and we just show each other, or we try to convince each other from our personal designs, and we discuss it, and it gets mixed up. Somebody starts drawing on top of another person's drawing, and this kind of fluid way of working, it makes that in the end we have explored all possibilities. And then we present three designs, three concepts to the client, three extremely different concepts. And after we present those concepts, the client knows that every option has been looked at.
Mm-hmm.
The concepts are extreme because they need to spark the conversation to keep developing the design to something that we all want to build and see in real life.
So this whole developed home office topic during COVID now is nothing that works for you. That you have work and living mixed up, fusioned, and you cannot really decide if you work or if you stay at home or if you travel to Bali and you work from there.
We're a two-person office, so if we would both be in Bali, it would be fine. It would be really good. But
we also have both separate personal lives that also need attention.
But I think it's different if you have to manage a project with a lot of people or just with the two of us. It's different,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I can imagine that there's a lot of like if it's drafting or. Like if you're working on
drawing details,
then it's different. But then again, even if you're drawing details, we still talk to each other like, hey, how would you do this?
Yeah.
How do you see it? And then
this instant feedback is important.
Yeah.
If there's a way, if it would be possible to have it
at home,
it wouldn't be a big issue, I guess. Yeah. But the instant feedback at any given time, that is important to us. Yeah. I think.
Okay, then how do you start your design process? When you start a competition, everybody, the two of you have to go to a separate room and you make your ideas, or do you sit together and you talk?
We talk a lot about
how
the
do you start
first.
It's a good question. What we do, how we start by going to the plot, going see the terrain and see what is specific about it. We have a lot of residential projects, so let's stick to this point of view. And we go to the plot and we see what's remarkable. We didn't notice. We may have seen some pictures and we say, oh, I didn't notice this tree or this building or the neighboring construction. And of course, we always ask what does the client really want? What is the program that they want? A lot of bedrooms? Do they want is the kitchen an important space? What is listen to how their life
or how they see their life in the future?
And I would say indeed both. So this is a document that we receive from the clients, and with this information and the site visit, I think with both we start brainstorming, and sometimes it's you take a piece of paper and you start drawing something.
Sometimes it's a small model.
Sometimes it's just conversation, or that you talk about something that you a concept that you already discussed in a previous project, but you never that was not suited for this for that client.
Mm-hmm.
And you start talking about it and sketching like just like on paper, pen and paper, small sketches. And since we start very conceptual in the beginning, it's easy to sketch it because it's oftentimes like a real concept that we try to work elaborate.
Yeah, and those concepts we discuss, and sometimes. It can happen that without having a client, we walk into the office and we say like, I dreamt something, or I found a new concept that I really like, and we show it to each other, and then it goes on the side on the shelf, and then after some time, it might pop up again when you start another project, and I remember that, and then maybe we can use that part or that. So it's really a process of triggering each other. It's like a game almost, like how can we get the best architectural design for this project?
And as Bram said, oftentimes we present three different proposals at the first presentation. So that's oftentimes like if I think about the concept and Bram thinks about one, we start developing them first separately a bit that they're clear for each other what we're trying to do, but we do present them as one. You could not be able, the client would not be able to tell, was this Bram's idea, was this one Hans' idea, and why why so?
And it's also very important, like in those first meetings, we do materialize the designs. Mm-hmm. We always make like plans, 3D presentations. And we materialize all the concepts in almost the same way, so that it's not about I like the brick one more than the
or dislike
the brick one and my idea go. It's all about the spatial concept, and then it starts developing in another phase because it's very difficult to make a design that's 100% to the client's taste from the first try. So we kind of the full design process, it takes, we always say 4 weeks, like for one design step. So if you come to us and you say, this is my brief, I want the project, we say, okay, 4 weeks later you get the three concepts. Once you've given your feedback on the three concepts, another 4 weeks, and we have the more developed design. And then you give feedback on that another 4 weeks, and then you have the final design. So that's how we try to master the time, not only from 9 to 5, but also for the projects in like 4 weeks is a phase for the design.
Have you ever had a client where the taste of him or her didn't fit yours at all and you couldn't match something? Did you arrive to the point to say, sorry, we can't do it?
Yeah, for sure. And it's better that it happens when you present the first design booklet than that it happens when you're already down the road together for I don't know how much money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that happens. And that's okay, because that means that that client is not the perfect match for the projects that we...
Yeah, and if there's a better suited architect, we would also tell them, you know,
yeah.
We would say this type of building or this house you're looking after
you should go
someone else,
yeah.
Go there.
And that's totally fine. It's better to arrive to that point as early as possible, or the earliest possible.
Yeah, we wouldn't continue with that.
It's also, we've had clients that ask us to do stuff that we don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Like even we that's
fair,
architecturally. Architecturally. Yeah, that's true. No, but in a way, like, it's very difficult as a starting office to set your boundaries, because you want to do projects. And then people, to do projects, you need money, because you need your office to keep running. But in the end, you invest in your future by deciding upfront what you want to be specializing in. You want to make great architecture for people that believe in you. And if people say, but yeah, guys, I will pay you another 100,000 euro if you design this type of villa for me, because I want to work with you guys, and you do that, then you might end up getting only clients for that type of construction.
Yeah.
And then you go down the rabbit hole. It's better to say no and to suck it up and not get any money, but to invest in your practice. And that's...
Yeah, that's true.
That's how we started. Like, okay, we want to make great architecture. We're not competitive in a lot of things, but architecture-wise, for us, that's the base of the office. We want to make what we believe is great architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, it's two guys who want to have fun. So that's the
architecturally.
Point. Yeah, architecturally, yeah. Well, I like to have fun outside the office as well, but okay.
And
that's how the 9 to 5 is actually pretty exciting.
It sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
It really does. In the River Tower from 9 to 5, having fun. Extraordinary projects. Yeah. Because in...
Like it.
Yes,
I see you imagine it. Yeah, so I'm thinking of considering it. Yeah.
Because in a lot of the other, probably in a lot of big offices, it's like a money machine where you can also sit from 9 to 5, mm-hmm. but you do things mm-hmm. that maybe not ask so much for your creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Did you experience this also, or did you start to be self-employed right away?
No.
We worked together in a big firm in Antwerp, Antwerp-based firm, with I think 75 employees, which is big scale for Belgium. So we know how it went, but it was a really nice working atmosphere as well.
Half
had a good
of
time.
The architects were under 30, so it was a really fun time. And the thing is, you always need to know why you invest your time working for someone else. Is it to gain experience?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because that office is creating things that you don't know how they work and you want to experience that?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because of the people? Can be. But in the end, it's very important to always, especially when you're not self-employed, to know why you're sitting in a certain office.
And be at any given time critical about it for yourself, considering why am I here? Why am I still here? Is it for the same reasons as last year?
What am I gaining from sitting in this office?
And I think in the field of architecture, the first years, the answer to this question should not be money.
No.
It should be, what am I learning? What am I getting out of this besides money? Because it's not the best.
You need a base income. We're not advocating offices to not pay their young employees, because we're totally against that. And that's also why we always say, like, if we hire someone, we should be able to pay them the way that we want to get paid for the experience that they have. And in a lot of offices, we see that young people are, like, big offices, young people are used as draftsmen, renderers, all these things. And it's okay if you as an employee don't mind doing that, it's fine. But if you want to do something else, you should be able to, like, okay. And the beauty about architecture is that you can do it anywhere in the world. So as a young graduating architect, it's so easy to send your portfolio to so many countries, so many offices, and just hope that you get picked up. And then you can travel the world by working in different offices. Mm. That can also be a reason to work in a big office. We've done that as well. But it's always important for yourself to know why you're doing something
like that. And be critical about it.
Yeah.
And honest.
And at what point did you say, okay, we have enough now?
It's a good question.
Let's start something.
It's a good question.
Well, the thing is that we when we started, I think we started because we found the right client, or the right client found us, but we didn't quit working for an architecture office instantly. We were like juggling two or three jobs.
Yeah.
Like Hans was working at the Velderving Tailleur as a project leader with big projects. So it's also not that you can cut the cord and be out of there. Same for me. I was working here in Antwerp and I was teaching at a university. So it was like we did the project together and we had our separate jobs. And then at some point you just have to jump and do it and hope you'll make it. And we've been very lucky.
Yeah. And I think you should be confident in, I think the design part you can have right away, straight after school. You can be confident about the design part. But it's, you should also be confident about the building experience and the technical aspects. Gain experience in these fields. And once you're confident about this and you know that you are creating projects for your boss, as if you would make them for yourself, as if you would be, there would be no difference between them though.
Yeah.
Then you could say, okay, if I would find a good client, or if I would find a good project, I would be able to do it for myself and I would do it this way. And of course, this doesn't happen overnight. It's more a transition. Like, okay, there's somebody interested in doing a project with us or with me. Shall I do? What shall I say? And I think it's more organic. It's not overnight.
And when you're in this design process, who or what from the architectural world, or it doesn't have to be from the architectural world, inspires you? When you have no idea at all, who inspires you or what? Nature? Do you have to take a walk outside?
Good question.
I think it's the living life to the fullest outside of the office that makes you got a lot of inspiration.
So for example?
By traveling, going, seeing buildings, even if we go to construction sites, most people would drive straight to the construction site. We often take like a D route because we have some spare time, and then we start looking at what's built or houses that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And that can be an inspiration. But I think in a lot of our designs, we only use the references to convince the clients. we don't use references to build up our designs, but we show references to show the client, to comfort them that it's already been done or that it's never been done. That can also be. But then in general, we are lucky that in Belgium we have a lot of great other offices and our history in architecture with like Julian Lampers and others is a great base to
that's true.
And we were discussing this earlier, like with for us it's not about who did the project or we have a lot of respect for architects in general, because we know how hard it is to make a great project and
to build it.
Yeah, to build it, to actually build it, to get the project to where you as an architect want it to be. It's super hard. And that makes that when I see a well-built house or something on the internet, you instantly have a respect for that architect because they managed to get it to a level that you're appreciating. And in a way that that if you see an architect then that produces 4 or 5 or 6 great buildings, your admiration grows because you realize like it's not a one lucky shot. Mm-hmm. It's somebody who is persistent, trying to push the boundaries of architecture, and that takes a lot of effort.
It's true. Yeah. More often we talk about a project and or something that we've seen and that we discuss this more than we say, let's talk about this architect and see what kind of solutions they come up with. It's more that we just think about a project and that we this happens though sometimes that we say, oh, this is really nice. Would it be a useful take on a new project to see how this works? And that happens sometimes.
And it's also a reason to, like, with all the we do the same. Eh? We post our stuff on Instagram and on social media. And usually when you see a picture on Instagram, it's like, whoa, this project. And then you start looking into it. And then it's disappointing when it's only from one side that it looks amazing. And then you feel like that's also a quality when an architect is able to not get a perfect building from one side, but like to really invest in the full attention of spatial design from all sides. And like sometimes you see a picture in a magazine and you think, like, amazing project. And then you visit the project and it's even better.
Or it's worse.
Worse. I hope that when I visit it, it's better.
When it's better, then it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It happened to you?
Like Villa van Wassenova by Julian Lampers. I a few birthdays ago, I booked it as a personal birthday present and I stayed there for 2 nights. And you really have the feeling, you know it from the magazines, you know it from the floor plan, but then when you enter the space and it's all about like the atmosphere, the vibe, the way it talks to you.
It sounds really inspiring. So you had your birthday there?
Yeah. That's such an architect's thing to do, too. To go visit another architect's place as a birthday present.
And now we come, in my opinion, to the most important topic. The world is on fire. What importance has nature in your project? What is your approach in terms of climate change?
It's actually two sides to the story. No, well, it has two two takes on it. The first one is that nature in general is really important to our architecture. We often have a quite interesting relation to or a perspective towards nature and how we bring nature inside. You can see our urban jungle in the office.
I see.
Or we oftentimes have patios with greenery. We have that the vegetation, surrounding vegetation, is really important for the building that we make. So on micro level, it's really important on the plot, the vegetation itself. But of course, like on macro, big scale, I think, for us, it's really important to make sustainable buildings. Of course, like, I think nobody would answer this question differently. By making sustainable buildings in general, like the way they are insulated, construction, insulation, solar panels, this whole discussion, I think, is so it's so important. I think this is evident.
But the thing is that in I don't know how it is for other countries, but in Belgium, you got specific rules about the energy loss of a building, and at some point it becomes almost like a computer program. Like, you have to fix this, and then that's the only option that you have to make a sustainable building. But we are also firm believers that sustainability, it's created by your design. The better your architecture, the more respect people will have for it. It's not a guarantee, of course. You can tell some nice brutalist buildings are being teared down all over the world, and the same happened with modernist buildings. But we believe that if the design is well thought through, that people will actually feel it, and the building will survive longer than a perfectly insulated small box, which is unlivable, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a big responsibility as an architect to make well-designed houses, because they will survive longer.
But do you think it makes sense to have all those rules to put a certain amount of insulation around your house that is produced in China? It's a lot of waste.
And that's why we
do that.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. And that's also why it's very important that your building doesn't get teared down, because when you tear it down, they don't recycle those materials, and it adds to the pollution even more. So the longer your building stays in use, the more sustainable it will get, because the first fault or the first interaction you do that's unsustainable is building that house. So if you could live in a house that's already existent and you renovate it, it's actually, I think, also a quite nice way to approach it.
That was actually the next question. Do you think there's still a need to build new houses? Or do you think this image of a family single house is still up to date? Or should we change our thinking about living space? Mm-hmm. Is this really up to date, having this single family home with the garden, with the fence around, the two cars, one dog? Mm-hmm. Is this up to date, or should we rethink this?
I think it's twofold, in the sense that if cities are very livable, and they invest in decompression spaces for people, then cities are the best way to go. Even towers having everybody together, but it all comes down to the design. I think that a self-sustaining house in the middle of nowhere, where the people don't need to drive their car to the grocery store because they have the vegetables on their roof, or they can work from home,
could
also be very sustainable. But I think there's a lot more possibilities in the city, because then you can start to share amenities, and by sharing amenities, you can then rethink a lot of ways of using stuff. Like does everybody still need to have like a washer and a dryer? Like when everybody has, for instance, a cleaning lady in a big building, it could be a service that's provided. And then mm-hmm. you can have very ecological, well-run machines that... both are a possibility. And I realize that not everywhere in the world, everybody can go live in a city. Mm. But it's a very important job to think about it. Because even if you would say like, okay, you're an architect, I have no control or I have very little control over the spatial layout of the city as an architect with my office. Mm-hmm. But if somebody asks me to build a house on a country road or in a country mm-hmm. Lane or out in nature, then I have a lot of control about how the house is being put there and how it respects mm-hmm. the site. And so I think everybody should invest in the way they can to the situation.
And how do you think artificial intelligence can help us to save the planet? Imagination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, everything of automation, everything where it helps to do processes that are like standard processes that can be done to do things more efficiently. Yeah. I think there artificial intelligence
comes in, or
practical things or driving cars or these kind mm-hmm. of things. This will be instant, of course. The everything that involves some sort of creativity of beauty, like as Bram said, you can live in a city, but if the city is designed just only functional or mm-hmm. only in a non-romantic or beautiful way, it will not be so appealing to do so. This mm-hmm. will be the first step to overcome, I guess, because you can tell even here where we live, different parts, if you move 500 meters, it's a different ambience, it's a different atmosphere, it's completely different. Just by the way, everything is composed and I think these layers or these design aspects will be tricky to be handed over to artificial intelligence in the first step, let's say, first phase of this transition to get us saved by artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And how do you imagine the future living space in terms of overpopulation? Do we all sit in little concrete boxes and the state says, okay, for each person, you have 10 square meters. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is possible in the future?
And then we have an avatar who can run free.
Yeah, yeah, you have your Oculus Rift glasses on and you actually don't move anymore.
Indeed.
Let's hope not.
it's possible. Yeah, I think everything with the metaverse and everything, there will, of course, be, this is getting really real, so this will be the case, but let's hope not.
But I think it's a very tricky situation because on one hand you could use artificial intelligence to streamline and to get more efficient ways of mm-hmm. constructing or even positioning things that we cannot think about, but that because artificial intelligence is not bound to the standard rules that we force onto ourselves, mm-hmm. New things might pop up. But I still think there's always this atmosphere, this thing about being human and having a human perspective on design, on cities that you cannot leave out. Mm-hmm. I would be scared that, like what you were saying about the little units, let's say artificial intelligence says like, okay, we have this many people in the world, so everybody gets this amount of square meters and we start over again. let's put everybody in little boxes. Yeah, that would be a scary thought.
Yeah.
But like if the artificial intelligence would present us those numbers and then we can interpret it and maybe present models to the artificial intelligence, then it can be like an extra sparring partner in a design process.
Yeah, that's true.
That would be cool. Like now when you design something and you have like fire regulations, the energy regulations, you have the accessibility regulations, and you want to make like 10 different designs to check out what are the possibilities, yeah, let the computer do it. And then I'll choose which one is best based on how I feel about it and my knowledge as an architect and as a human being. But I don't want an intern to sit down and have to work out 100 models to get to the one that I like, for instance. So we can use artificial intelligence to take a lot of our boring jobs, the 9-to-5s, out of the equation, and everybody can live a little bit more, and we have more time for life. And yeah, that would be nice.
Okay, so you answer this question with a positive vision.
Yeah, of course.
Otherwise, it wouldn't make
Otherwise,
any sense.
Otherwise, we can just jump out of the window and it's worse.
Now I can go back to my small concrete square and think. Thank you.
It's the same with like robots and stuff. I would love to have robots to do my laundry. Why not? Let them do it so I can do other fun stuff.
Huh? So I must say, when I watch the news and I see this little robot dog in China walking around the streets, it gives me a little pressure, I must say.
Yeah, but that dog is used for other things, no? The robot dog, if it's used for like surveillance and security and these kind of things, I don't want a robot dog in the street. But if that robot dog is there to, like, for instance, clean out the gutters and do stuff that now have to be done by manual labor, then I would love that dog to be around and let it do its thing. But it's
Sorry. And what happens to the people then?
Well, I think at some point we have to be fair. And if robots start to do things, then everybody just gets a pay like you would be a pensioner. Mm-hmm. And then the robots do our dirty jobs and all the work, and we can just have more time to spend with family. And
we live life to the fullest.
Yeah. Be creative and do things. Because if you ask people now, a lot of people do a 9-to-5 job that they think is boring. Mm-hmm. If you ask them, what would you like to do? Yeah, I would like to paint. I would like to sing. I would like to ride a horse. But I don't have time for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they could leave that job, they would do all these things. And maybe then we get a lot of amazing art and a lot of other things. And people start to think when you have spare time, you start to think and good things happen. No?
Mm-hmm.
I hope so.
Probably we will find it out sooner or later. Maybe. So, last question. What means architecture for you personally? You can also quote someone.
That's very personal then. But he had a good opinion, so I chose him to.
Yeah, because there comes always a really long break before the answer. So.
Yeah.
You're not going to cut those
out. You can
cut
it out.
Right?
You can cut it out. So I quote. No, it's a good question. What does it mean? I think for us, it means we create a lot of residential spaces, architecture. It means when we create it ourselves, we try to make, we are conscious of the best thing is nature everywhere, beautiful nature, beautiful landscapes. And if you have to touch it, if you have to implement something, then it better be good. It better be really, really good. And when this happens, when you have the feeling there was nothing here and now something is here and it is not bad. We like it. It's even maybe a better place than with only nature. Then this for me is architecture. And this can be like a small village on top of a mountain where you like to play hide and seek between the walls. It can be a building on its own. It can be something. If I have this feeling, for me, this is architecture. And it can be a big Duomo of Firenze. It can be a house in the forest, or it can be something really small or really big. This feeling, I think, where you touch it and it is still good, this is architecture. You can quote me now. It's okay. Go ahead.
No, I think, yeah. Architecture, what is architecture for me? I use architecture as a kind of backbone for a lot of things. Like it's a balance, like the living life to the fullest and implementing it in architecture makes them intertwined. And yeah, I think that if everybody would try to see the effort that's put into it, we'll all have better spaces and places. Yeah. It's a difficult.
You can still quote me.
Yeah, I'll quote.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was an amazing talk. Thank you for your time and for the possibility to talk to you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
This was this week's episode. We really hope you liked it as much as we did. If you have comments, suggestions, critique, please let us know. And till next time on What's Next. Ciao, ciao.